Judiciary Committee will now come to order. The time is now 1:06 p.m. on Wednesday, March 25th, 2026. We are meeting in the Grunberg Room, Capitol Room 120. The following members are present: Representative Vance, Representative Costello, Representative Mina, and myself, Chair Gray. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. I would like to recognize the staff supporting this meeting: Sophia Tenney from House Records, Susan Quigley from the Juno LIO, and my committee aide, Dylan Hitchcock Lopez. We have three items of business on today's agenda. First, we will consider the governor's appointee to the State Commission for Human Rights. Then we will have House Bill 308, blood, breath, alcohol content limits, HB 324, virtual currency kiosks, and HB 136, railroad utility corridors. I apologize for the mistake. We have four items of business on today's schedule. We welcome Representative Jubilee Underwood at 1:07 p.m. Our first item of business is the consideration of the governor's appointee to the State Commission for Human Rights, Mary Grace Salazar. The Alaska State Commission for Human Rights is the state agency that enforces the Alaska Human Rights Law. The commission consists of seven commissioners appointed by the governor and confirmed by the legislature. The commission employs a staff and maintains an office in Anchorage. The commission has statewide powers and accepts and investigates complaints from individuals across all regions of the state. Ms. Salazar, if you can take yourself off mute and put yourself on the record and begin your opening comments.
Yes, good afternoon. Through the chair and members of the Judiciary Committee, this is Mary Grace Salazar, and thank you for the opportunity to speak before you today. As you can see from my resume, I served the state for 30 years, and after retiring in 2022, felt strongly that I still had more to contribute. I bring decades of state government experience and a strong understanding of our communities around the state and a dedication to fairness, dignity, and thoughtful decision making. Again, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Salazar. Are there any questions from the committee? Seeing none, we will open up for public testimony. Is there anyone in the room who would like to testify about the appointment of Ms. Salazar? Seeing none, we will look online. Seeing none online, we will close public testimony on Ms. Salazar. Any questions or comments from committee members? Representative Mina.
Hi, thank you, Ms. Salazar. Thank you for putting your name forward through the chair for this commission. Could you just talk a bit more about your background and your passion and interest in serving on the Commission for Human Rights?
Ms. Salazar.
Yes, thank you. Again, I served the state of Alaska for over 30 years, starting with the state ombudsman's office back in 1991. Then moving on to Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, where I serve as a grants administrator and an audit specialist. Then after Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, I moved over to the Regulatory Commission of Alaska, where I spent over collectively 15 years of my time there, partly as an admin officer, and then became as the head of the Consumer Protection Office, where I spoke with public utility customers regarding rates and services of public utilities in the state of Alaska. And prior to my retirement, I spent the last year with Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. And in addition to that experience, I completed several business and accounting courses throughout my career, as well as state of Alaska training courses. And so that's my background. I am an empty nester. My youngest son is in college in up in Fairbanks, and my daughter just graduated from University of Gonzaga, and been here in Alaska for over 36 years now, and I'm very passionate about serving the state of Alaska. And like I said, I've been around the state, served as an outreach coordinator during my time with the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. So I have a very strong understanding of our communities and the residents of the state of Alaska. And I'm very passionate about continuing that service.
Thank you, Ms. Salazar. Any other questions from committee? Ms. Salazar, thank you so much for your time and your willingness to serve. In accordance with AS 39.05.080, the Judiciary Committee held a hearing on the following appointee, Mary Grace Salazar, State Commission for Human Rights. A signature on the report that we're about to sign does not reflect an intent by any of the members to vote for or against ratification of the individual during any further session. We will now take a brief at ease to sign the paperwork. On the record, I would like to state that we were joined by Representative Kopp at 1:11 p.m. and by Representative Eichheit at 1:13 p.m. Our next item of business is House Bill 308, Blood, Breath, Alcohol Content Limits, sponsored by myself, Representative Gray. At this time, I would like to invite my staff, Carly Thrun, to the witness table. I will join her, and I will hand the gavel over to Representative Kopp.
Thank you, Chair Gray. We'll give you just a moment, sir, to get set up. And thank you, Ms. Thrun. Please put yourself on the record and walk us through the sectional and any presentation materials you have.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. For the record, my name is Carly Thrun. I am legislative intern for Representative Gray of House District 20. Good afternoon, Chair Kopp and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to present House Bill 308 today for you guys. And if it is at the will of the committee, I'll move to the sectional analysis.
Vice Chair Kopp, I'm going to do my introductory statement.
Oh, yeah. Thank you.
For the record, I'm Representative Andrew Gray. I represent House District 20, the UMed District. I will state that this introductory statement was authored by my intern, Carly Thrun. Every year, impaired driving shatters families and devastates communities across Alaska. These crashes are not accidents. They are preventable. HB 308 proposes lowering Alaska's legal blood alcohol concentration, BAC, limit to 0.04. This change would align the state with federal regulations, which recognize the safety hazards of driving with a BAC above 0.04. Under federal law, commercial drivers, CDL holders, must maintain a BAC below 0.04, reflecting the increased risk of impairment at this level. Applying this same limit to all drivers would create consistent and safer driving laws across the state. Impairment from alcohol begins well before the legal limit of 0.08 BAC. Even at a BAC of 0.02, drivers can experience slower reaction times, reduced coordination, and difficulty tracking moving objects, meaning driving ability is already affected at low levels of alcohol. As BAC rises to 0.05, the risk of being involved in a fatal crash is 7 times more likely. In 2023, about 5% of fatal crashes involving impairment in Alaska occurred when BAC levels were between 0.01 and 0.07. Utah dropped its BAC limit to 0.05, becoming the first state to implement a lower limit, which demonstrated the effectiveness of this approach. The state experienced a notable 19.8% reduction in the fatal crash rate within the first year of implementation. This decline in fatalities occurred without any adverse effects on alcohol sales, overall consumption, or tourism revenue, effectively addressing common concerns that stricter BAC regulations might negatively affect local businesses or the tourism industry. This bill is not about restricting responsible adults or discouraging social gatherings. It is about keeping our roads safe and making it clear that drinking and driving should be separated. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Gray. Are there any questions for the sponsor or his staff committee? Representative Vance.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman. So this is a bold bill. I like it. But I don't when someone gets pulled over, they have to take a breathalyzer. How is that, is it pass or fail, or is there, does it show the 0.04, walk us through that, and how this would be walked out in practical terms for the public.
Thank you. Through the chair, and although the chair may be the best person to answer this with a career in law enforcement, but I will say, as someone who's actually had to blow into a breathalyzer before, I know that it gives a number. And so this would be changing that number. Now, if it's below 0.08, then they say, yes, you are under the legal limit, you are free to go. Now that number would be lower. So that's how that would work, is that a DUI would have a new definition, which is if you're above 0.04. I will say that my intern has a great slide presentation that's going to give a lot of very interesting facts about this. So I think it might be good for her to finish her presentation before we do additional questions.
I will wait for the presentation.
Thank you, Representative Vance. Please proceed, Representative and Ms. Thune. Thank you.
Yes. Would you guys, if it is at the will of the committee, I'll move into the sectional analysis of the bill. And for the record, my name is Carly Thrun. Section 1 lowers the intoxication threshold for release from a correctional facility from 0.08 to 0.04 BAC before an intoxicated person may be released. Section 2 updates the definition of previously convicted to include convictions based on a 0.04 BAC standard instead of 0.08. Section 3 reduces the per se DUI limit from 0.08 BAC to 0.04, including equivalent blood and breath alcohol measurements. Section 4 updates DUI evidentiary presumptions to reflect the 0.04 BAC standard and removes the former 0.04 to 0.08 intermediate presumption range. Section 5 clarifies the act applies to offenses committed on or after the effective date, while prior convictions still count for repeat offense purposes. And Section 6 sets the effective date as January 1st, 2027. And if it is at the will of the chair, I will now move into the presentation.
Thank you.
For the record, again, my name is Carly Thrun, legislative intern to Representative Gray. To begin, I would like to emphasize the importance of lowering the current blood alcohol content limit from 0.08 to 0.04. The 0.04 blood alcohol content limit isn't experimental. It is already a well-established standard for commercial driver's license holders. Extending this limit to all drivers would apply an existing evidence-based safety standard more consistently. The current 0.08 limit can send the unintended message that drinking up to that level is safe, despite clear evidence that impairment can begin much earlier. The National Highway Safety Transportation Administration notes that signs of impairment, like reduced coordination, ability to track moving objects, and difficulty steering, begins at blood alcohol contents around 0.04. HB 308 reframes the law from tolerating a degree of impairment to actively prioritizing safety for everyone on the road. Alcohol remains the drug with the most significant and harmful impact on traffic safety. In Alaska, 2.6% of adults self-reported having driven after consuming too much alcohol within the past 30 days. This rate is notably 65% higher than the national average. These statistics highlight a troubling reality that impaired driving is underestimated. Even in countries with comparable alcohol consumption, stricter blood alcohol concentration laws save lives. In the Netherlands, their limit is 0.05, and the average person drinks about 2.6 gallons of alcohol per year, comparable to Alaska's 2.7. Yet alcohol is involved in far more fatal crashes here, roughly 29% in Alaska versus the 19% in the Netherlands. We know that alcohol impacts everyone differently and varies due to factors like weight, metabolism, sex, and drinking history. The graph included provides a general idea of how many drinks it might take for different people to reach certain blood alcohol content levels. Notice the yellow zone. According to the National Safety Council, when rising to a BAC of 0.04, the crash risk increases by 18% compared to when you are completely sober. This is not just a small dip in ability, it's a significant reduction in safe, responsible functioning.
When Utah lowered their blood alcohol content limit to 0.05 in 2018, the state experienced a 19.8 reduction in fatal crash rates in the first year. Notably, 22% of people also noted that they changed their behavior once the law went into effect. Additionally, lowering the BAC has not harmed the economy in Utah. Alcohol sales have continued to grow, rising from $405 million in 2016 before the law took effect to $479 million in 2020 and reaching $551 million in 2025.
Excuse me, Ms. Theroux, you're doing a great job.
Thank you.
Could you slow it down?
Yes.
Lots of good information there. I just want to capture what you're saying.
Thank you. Yeah, absolutely. And so just to reiterate, the alcohol sales have continued to grow. Before the law was implemented, the revenue was $405 million in 2016. And then in 2020, 2 years after, it grew to $479 million. And then now in 2025, it has reached $551 million. Revenue from restaurants, hotels, rental cars, resorts, and air travel have also remained strong in Utah. Within the first year of implementation, DUI arrests have decreased by 4%. Since, there's been a slight increase of about 3.7% over a five-year period from 2020 to 2025. At the same time in Utah, the per capita DUI arrest rate has steadily declined, reaching a historic low of 31.1 per 10,000 residents in 2025. This decline has occurred even as Utah's population has grown by 27%, meaning that the likelihood of any individual resident being arrested for driving under the influence has decreased overall. It's important to note that HB 308 does not change how officers decide who to pull over. Enforcement still begins with observed driving behavior and signs of impairment before any DUI action is taken. Finally, it is important to note that while Utah is the first state in the United States to implement this measure, both Washington and Hawaii have introduced legislation to lower their blood alcohol limits as well. Countries around the world have recognized the necessity of stricter regulations and have been implementing legislation to keep their roads safer for decades. International research shows a similar pattern to that of Utah. Lowering blood alcohol content limits allows a decrease in fatal and injury crashes due to impaired driving. House Bill 308 seeks to promote safety for all Alaskans and aims to keep our laws consistent. Thank you, Chair Kopp and the committee, for hearing House Bill 308.
Thank you. Great sectional presentation. Any questions from committee members? Representative Eichheit.
Thank you, Co-Chair Kopp, or Vice Chair Kopp. Through the Vice Chair, a couple questions. Not sure if the sponsor can answer this or this is a Department of Law question, but in a traffic enforcement action where an officer, a road officer, has some kind of probable cause of impairment, you know, the classic things, wandering, the car's wandering through the lane, and they stop the individual. And based on that probable cause observations, they conduct a field sobriety test, you know, all the things, walking in a line, so on and so forth. Question I have is, in Alaska law, if the subject of the stop passes the field sobriety test, can the officer compel that individual to take a blood alcohol, a breathalyzer test?
Can you call Nancy Mead up?
Sure. And we also have online Captain Scott Bartlett, I believe, from Department of Public Safety.
Bartlett. Okay.
And Emil or Ariel Toff from the Public Defender. So would you prefer one of those, Representative Gray, or would you prefer
one of those?
Okay. Captain Bartlett, are you online, sir, or were you able to hear the question?
I believe I was, and I'm also accompanied by Corporal Nate Johnson. He's one of our DUI instructors, and I'm going to actually have him speak to most of these questions. Can you repeat the question?
Go ahead, Representative.
Yes. Very simply, if a road officer pulls over somebody who's driving that appears impaired and during the investigation conducts the classic field sobriety test, you know, walking a straight line. If the subject that was pulled over, quote, passes those field sobriety tests, can the officer compel the subject to do a blood alcohol test, you know, blow into the blood alcohol measuring device?
Okay, through the chair, for the record, my name is Corporal Nate Johnson with the Department of Public Safety. I can speak to that. So for an officer to compel an individual to provide a breath sample, the officer does have to have probable cause. And so probable cause is commonly gained through field sobriety tests, and that's a big purpose of field sobriety testing, is to give the officer probable cause to make an arrest and ultimately to compel the driver to provide a breath sample. But that probable cause can also be obtained through other means, right? Other mediums of, observations, sights, sounds, smells, et cetera. So typically, if a driver passes field sobriety tests, it's very common that the officer will immediately allow the person, I shouldn't say allow them to go, but they'll consider it as a, they passed, they're not under the influence. NHTSA, so the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, when they teach SFSTs, says that they're not necessarily a pass-fail test and just a tool, really, to help you see signs of impairment. But how we teach them at the academy is typically closer to a pass-fail, whereas if you don't meet kind of a threshold, then they're typically seen as more of a pass-fail. But ultimately, if the officer, independent of the field sobriety test, has probable cause based on, say, observations of driving behavior, observations of the individual, then provided they can articulate that probable cause, an arrest could be made and the person could be compelled to provide a breath sample.
Follow-up.
Yes, Representative Eichhagen.
So I was looking for the classic yes no answer. I'm just so here is, another context. If an officer is following somebody and they are wandering through the lane, I mean, I've reported people doing that as a driver on a ready type situation, and so they pull them over. And I guess the question is, and there is no alcohol observed. There is no alcohol in anyone's breath. Perhaps the person slurs. Some people have speech impediments. But what I'm really asking is, if this subject passes the field sobriety test, can the officer compel them to a breathalyzer test? Do they have that latitude? It's yes or no? What stands up in a court of law?
Representative Eichhagen, who are you directing the question to?
The gentleman that just spoke.
Okay. Yes. Thank you, Representative. Captain Bartlett, you or your fellow trooper, please proceed.
Through the chair, for the record, my name is Corporal Nate Johnson with the Department of Public Safety. So again, I'm hesitant to say, typically most officers, if an individual passes field sobriety tests, are probably going to end the investigation right there. But like I said, they're not, NHTSA doesn't even teach them as a pass-fail necessarily, because the clues that we use when we determine whether a person, quote, passes or fails, really are just an indication of the likelihood of a person's being under the influence based on multiple studies that NHTSA completed back from the 70s to the 90s. And the most recent research we have as far as field sobriety tests comes from the late 90s. So like I said, typically that's probably going to be the end of it. But if there's a whole bunch of other facts, and you mentioned what we would probably call drifting in the lane or weaving in the lane, depending on the vehicle's specific, whatever action the driver's taking there. If you have that and you have a whole bunch of other factors, it's possible that maybe an arrest could be made, based on your observations of their demeanor, what they're
what maybe their speech, their, you know, bloodshot eyes, whatever it is, you know, because and obviously the focus of this bill is not on drug impairment, but there's many other substances besides just alcohol that can impair a person's ability to drive. So, again, an officer would have to have probable cause, and I think that you'd find that nearly all officers, if an individual passes field sobriety tests, are going to end the investigation right there. And they'll probably do one of a couple things. They might discourage the driver from driving. That's very common, especially in cases where we know the person has had some alcohol on board or maybe is possibly under the influence of drugs, but not to the extent that we can prove it impairs their driving. But we are concerned about it, especially, you know, given the we know that alcohol below levels of a 0.08 can be, it still affects a person's ability to make decisions, right? So per DPS policy, if a driver is over a 0.05, we discourage them from driving, right? It's not that we force them to not drive, but we try to find some other means for them to get a ride or someone else to drive them. So I think that you would find that most officers at the time that field sobriety tests have been passed, if you will, would conclude the investigation, yes.
Thank you, Corporal. Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair, I just wanted to point back to this slide that my intern had up. So you can see that right now, a field sobriety test needs to check and see if a 240-pound man has had less than 5 drinks before he took the wheel. If this law passed, then we'd be checking to see if that 240-pound man had had less than 3 drinks. You're going to need to change the field sobriety test. The field sobriety test is going, in other words, right now, if you just down 4 shots, you might walk a little wobbly. You might do a couple things wrong, but you're still going to pass. You're still legal to drive after those 4 shots that you just downed. A 200-pound woman will be doing 3 less than, you know, right now you need less than 4 drinks. So she could have done 3 shots and got behind the wheel. She's going to pass. But what I'm saying is if we change the law, well, then we need to change the way we do our field sobriety tests. It needs to be a more difficult field sobriety test. It needs to, because we're trying to check that lower amount of alcohol consumed. I just love this chart because I think it shows, you know, I think most people think that if you've had, and let's face it, some people are going to get away with 5 drinks and still pass that 0.08 limit. Like they'll come in at 0.79 and be legal. I think it's, well, obviously we're sponsoring the bill. We think 5 drinks is too much before you drive your car.
Thank you, Representative Gray. Representative Eichheit.
Yeah. Thank you, Vice Chair Kopp. Thank you for that. And I do think the officer answered the question. At least I was able to extract something from that. So I appreciate that. well, getting to the number of drinks and the blood alcohol content, I did notice in the materials that for some people, 1 drink would put them over the 0.04 limit. But I also read the materials and it talked about an impairment starting as low as 0.01. So I'm curious, I know why you picked 0.04. I think, you know, CDL requirements. But the question is, if the goal is to reduce impairment and hence reduce alcohol-related deaths, I think that's maybe the key phrase, why have 0.04 if the goal is to reduce deaths and go to 0.1? Or 0.01, I should say, 0.02, 0.03.
Through the chair to Representative Eichheit, I would just like to go back to the point of – oh, sorry. For the record, my name is Carly Thrun. I would just like to go back to the point that we are aiming to keep our laws consistent. That is truly, you know, the kind of aim at the 0.04. To my understanding, commercial driver's license holders, when they do breathalyze or have a 0.02%, they're not allowed to drive for 24 hours. Like they're removed from working. And so, you know, I don't think anyone should be driving impaired, but we wanted to make sure that the claim was to keep our laws consistent when we have, you know, the federal laws already stating that this is a safety issue. And so we want to keep that a consistent measure. Thank you.
Representative Eichheit.
Yeah, a final one. Thank you for that. So I understand the goal is to keep it consistent with the federal standard for CDL. Okay. And
through the chair, I'll just say to Representative Eichheit, we are open to that amendment. I will say that I was at the gym this morning before floor, and there was a reality show on taking place in Norway where someone had a single drink and their friend said, you know, you can't drive the snow machine in Norway because and I think the color is wrong because from my research after watching the show, it's 0.02 in Norway. And so really they do have it set so that if you have a single drink, you can't operate a motor vehicle, including a snow machine. And with a penalty, if it's above 0.05, of jail for a month and your license revoked for 2 years. So just an incredibly powerful consequence if you are operating that snow machine after one drink. And their thing, they kind of explain it. They're like, Norway is a very cold country. You know, people need to have their wits about them. Even one drink, you could kill yourself and whoever's on board with you. We take it very seriously. So, I mean, I love this slide. I'm grateful that my intern made it. Just 84% of the world's population lives in a country with BAC limits of 0.05 or lower. I just think it just really points out that the United States is an outlier in allowing people to drink so much and drive and considering that legal.
And my final question, if I may.
Representative Eichheit.
Through the vice chair. So I'm looking at the sponsor statement. And it was about the Utah's experience in paragraph 4, said that after they lowered their blood alcohol content to 0.05, the state experienced a notable 19.8% reduction in the fatal crash rate within the first year implementation. Now, I am a data-driven former science teacher. The implication of that statement is it was due to lowering the blood alcohol limit. But what I'm asking is this based on a study where folks looked at all the factors that might result in a reduction in driver fatalities, i.e., if you have a here in a winter state, and I think Utah is a winter state, if you have a mild winter, less icy conditions, that could result. So I'm asking, was there a multivariate study done that parsed out what percent of that reduction in deaths was due to the 0.05 blood alcohol?
Yeah, through the chair to Representative Eichheit, for the record, Carly Thrun. I don't have a determinate answer on that. I do have the study, and I can send it to you and make sure I get that back to you for your information. To my understanding, it was only looking at the specific variable that is the lowering the limit, but I can definitely double check that for you and get it back.
Yes, please. Thank you.
And I'll say through the chair that we do have someone from NTSB as invited testimony who might be able to speak to that. And we also have other invited testimony in the room who will be providing additional data.
Thank you.
Are there any other committee members? Otherwise, I'll have a couple questions. Yes, Representative Mina. Yes.
Thank you, Vice Chair Kopp. Through the Vice Chair, I was curious that since in the U.S., the BAC is 0.08 and it's higher internationally, why is there that difference?
Through the chair to Representative Mina, if I'm understanding your question right, I think you're asking, you know, the chart that we're seeing right now, it really is kind of singling out the U.S. And Canada, and everywhere else kind of has the darker colors. I'm not exactly sure the reason. I would like to say that that is attributed to the fact that we have seen the studies prove that BACs lower than 0.05 help deter people from drinking and driving and reduce the fatalities.
Through Vice Chair Kopp to Representative Mina. I think our invited testimony may have information. I believe we used to be at 1.0. I believe we've been steadily lowering. And so I think it's not necessarily that the entire world has had limits this low. It's just that as time has gone by, they've seen the value of it and they've been lowering them at a faster rate than we have. But I would wait for invited testimony who are subject matter experts.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Gray, and thank you, Ms. Thrun. So some policy considerations in front of the committee are if the question that the bill sponsor is presenting is to align the 04 standard with the CDL standard, commercial driver's license standard, we need to think about that 04 standard was set because that is considered a professional driver liability, a critical safety operator position, much like in aviation or other things where you think, yeah, we cannot have those people impaired. And the penalties they face are dramatically more severe. So at a same, if we lowered this to a 04 right now, you know, without amending anything, you would have a first offense driver having their license revoked for 90 days if you had a normal driver's license, or 1 year if it was a CDL. If it was your second offense, a normal driver would be revoked for a year. CDL driver would be revoked for life. For life. So same standard, 04. And the other thing is the 04 standard applies even if a CDL driver is in their personal vehicle. They will lose their right to drive or use their CDL for anything for that period of time I just sent you. A normal driver, first offense, can get a limited license to drive and work if it's their first offense. A CDL driver, no. They're down for the count for a year. So if we're going to lower that standard, I'm just wondering if we're creating some incongruence in the law. If the purpose in the first place was to bring a professional liability standard to critical safety positions, and we just need to think about how do we map that out so that it's proportional. The law should be proportional, and so I'm only talking about strictly the one narrow aspect of the bill, and that's penalties.
To the vice chair, I would say that the intent is to have people driving with less impairment. I wasn't trying to make it consistent as far as consequences to non-commercial drivers. So in other words, no change to the current penalties for driving impaired for non-commercial driver's license holders. It was simply to say, if professionally we're going to say that 0.04 is the cutoff for impaired driving for professional drivers, let's say that it's actually the cutoff for all drivers.
Right. Yeah, thank you. And the goal to reduce drunk driving is very laudable. Thank you. Great. In the context of kind of going down this path, I think it's important that the committee understand that the 08 standard, which it is now, is considered a per se standard, which means you're guilty on the face. No other evidence is needed if you can show that someone was a 08. So the 04 standard that Representative Gray is proposing would be a per se legal standard. Now, officers now can arrest for DUI, even if you're less than that. They could arrest for DUI now at a 04 or a 03 if the combination of observed driving, observed behavior, smell of alcohol, slurred speech, badly performing on the field, standardized field sobriety tests, you know, all those things go into that. Conversely, if someone does really well, if you stopped them for a headlight out, really no other driving violation, just an equipment violation, and they seem completely alert, do great on the field sobriety tests, but you're still thinking they may have had some vodka or something I can't smell, you can ask them to take a preliminary breath test. But they don't have to. If they refuse, you can give them a citation. But that preliminary breath test, if they comply, can be used as part of your probable cause for arrest. So there is, it's like building a foundation. There's a lot of observations that go into that decision to arrest. So my point is that right now they can arrest below that standard. And only if the probable cause justifies an arrest, then you go to the duty station or wherever the intoximeter, or I'm dating myself now, I don't even know what they call those machines anymore, but you know, that is where you would have your official breath test. And then if there's an injury involved, you can get a warrant for blood and, you know, all those things. But so we're, I guess, a couple things. So they already can arrest for lower than the standard. I guess that's what I'm saying, is the 08 is already not limiting law enforcement. If they think that someone's DUI, that 08 barrier is not a barrier to making an arrest for DUI. And secondly, we're just thinking about the proportionality of lowering that. Captain Bartlett, are you online, or Corporal? Are you there, sir?
Yep.
Yeah, okay. Just any thoughts you have on anything I just said, or add to, or take away from, or did I get anything wrong?
To the chair, for the record, my name is Corporal Nate Johnson with the Department of Public Safety. You're absolutely correct. Under subsection A1 of the current DUI statute, provided that we can prove, and by we, law enforcement can prove impairment, an arrest can be made at, you know, limits below, or I should say levels below that per se standard that's seen in subsection A2. So in many cases, you know, especially with, you know, drugs and things like that, it may be the case that they're well under that, right? Because maybe they're under the influence of both drugs and alcohol, and alcohol doesn't come anywhere close to that 0.08 standard. So because both of those subsections are within the statute, we can certainly enforce the law, provided there's impairment at levels below a 0.08.
Okay. Thank you, Corporal. Questions from the committee? Any questions? Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I appreciate the bigger picture insight that you're giving us with the CDL and the changes. And it leads to some of the questions that I have on the bill, Section 3. It talks about a person who operates or drives a motor vehicle, operates an aircraft or a watercraft. And I think I would like more information provided to the committee about the federal authority over aircraft, watercraft in the state, what those limits are. Also the CDL, I believe that we have a lot of federal guidelines, and compare them to the state so that we can kind of understand. I live in a coastal community, and so the water that we engage with is usually the boats are regulated federal. Now, the interior, probably a different situation, but I think having that side by side to see how that interacts, because consistency in law so that people can know what the expectation is helpful. And then I had another question. You got me going. Now I'll
come back to you.
Yeah, I think in reading up on the information that was provided, I think by the evidence from Utah, this proves to be extremely preventative rather than punitive, which I find impressive that they it caused more people to plan ahead to have a designated driver or a ride home rather than creating more arrests. And I think that's something to take into consideration. But also, Mr. Chairman, the question came back to me. If we could have the limits or the CDL information kind of a side-by-side in what those penalties are, and a recommendation from DPS and Department of Law, not wanting to make this bill bigger, but I just want to understand this. This isn't a topic that we've discussed in quite some time, and I really appreciate all the slides and information that you've provided. And I encourage just the public who's listening to take a look at the documents. There's 30 pages worth, but they do have a lot of really good information.
Thank you, Representative Vance. Question for the bill sponsor. What states or how many have a standard, let's say, of a 0.5 or 0.4?
Through the chair, there's one. It's Utah. It's 0.05. So this would make Alaska number one.
Yeah.
We'd have the lowest.
I guess that would make sense because Utah's always had the light beer, 2% beer, Salt Lake itself for a long time. So you take a dim view on that. Well, very good. Well, if there's no more questions from the committee, let's go to Representative Eichheit. Yeah.
Thank you, Vice Chair Kopp. Through the Vice Chair, just two questions related to the Utah experience, because I think that's the most impactful information. Well, just really one. So based on the discussion about current penalties, you know, if somebody is convicted of a DUI and having their license suspended for 90 days and a year, I'm curious if there's been any studies yet in Utah, if there is a disparate impact on disadvantaged communities. And the context is, so I live about 18 minutes drive from the Ted Stevens International Airport. And I can afford a Lyft or Uber or taxi there. And many places are served by public transit, but not all places are. And, you know, the last Lyft drive ride I got it to the airport, it cost me $55. Kind of hurt a little bit. And so the question I have is, has there been any studies in Utah on the impact of convictions where people lose their ability to drive in the context of areas where people don't make a lot of money? And what's the impact on them economically? And I'm thinking about losing their job if they are folks that drive to work. Is there any information on that?
Through the chair to Representative Eichheit, for the record, Carly Thrun. I think that it would be a great question for our invited testimony at the National Transportation Safety Board, who's online. They have a really good overview of that stuff. And I would be happy to look into it myself as well.
Thank you. Thank you. So, committee, if there's no further questions, and it's okay with the bill sponsor, we can now turn to invited testimony on House Bill 308. So our first invited testifier is Tiffany Hall, President and CEO of Recover Alaska. Ms. Hall, please come up to the front. Yes, you are here, and put yourself on the record and begin your testimony.
Thanks very much to the chair and members of the committee. Thank you for this opportunity to speak. For the record, my name is Tiffany Hall. I serve as the CEO of Recover Alaska. We're a statewide nonprofit working to reduce the harms of alcohol across the state, across prevention, treatment, and recovery services. Before I start, I just want to say I'm so excited by your questions. They are so logical and it is so refreshing. Thank you for being so thoughtful about this. I'm here today in support of HB 308 to lower the legal BAC from 0.08 to 0.04. In Alaska, one in three, at least, traffic deaths involves a driver with a BAC of 0.08 or higher. More broadly, Alaskans are dying from alcohol at rates nearly three times higher than the rest of the nation. This is not theoretical. This is an urgent public health need and a safety issue that we are facing right now. And there's a very important gap in our current law. About one in 20 of our traffic fatalities have a BAC of 0.05 to 0.07. So it's a clear gap that this bill would be closing. We know this approach works because as a nation, we have done it before. And as individual states, from 0.15 to 0.1 to 0.08, and Utah down to 0.05. When Utah lowered to 0.05, fatalities declined. So we know it's not just those changes that were happening through the 80s and 90s. We know it still will work now, today. They work not just because of enforcement, but because they shift behavior across the population. People make different decisions about whether to drive after drinking. I love what you said about preventive versus punitive. Recover Alaska loves things that work upstream because it's better to solve the problem before it starts. Research shows that lowering BAC limits reduces crashes at all levels: high BAC drivers, middle BAC drivers, low BAC drivers, not just those right near the 0.08. And that matters here because, again, in Alaska, one in three of our traffic fatalities have a 0.08 BAC or higher. The science is very clear. Impairment does not begin at 0.08. It starts at least by 0.05, but in some cases as low as 0.01 or 0.02. Most people experience reduced reaction time, coordination, and decision-making ability, reductions in all of those by 0.04. In other words, the current legal limit is higher than where meaningful impairment begins. New research has come out since that 0.08 decision, and this bill simply aligns the law with that reality. There's also a broader prevention impact that's especially important here in Alaska, again. Policies like this don't just affect driving. They help shape social norms around alcohol use. There's a study showing lower BAC limits are associated with reduced overall drinking, particularly among women of childbearing age. That matters here because Alaska has higher rates of fetal alcohol spectrum disorders than the national average, and more than half of Alaska's pregnancies are unplanned. So if we can reduce drinking in that population, we don't just reduce risk on the road, we reduce risk in future generations across the board. This bill does not change how law enforcement operates. Officers will still use the same indicators to make a stop and the same standardized field sobriety test to assess impairment. I have a note on this, but specifically about that, the field sobriety stops generally include three different aspects: standing on one leg, the turnaround and walk on a line. I forget what the fun names for them are called. And there's a vision test that you can tell if the pupils are moving, and that is just as effective at 0.05 as it is at 0.08.
No cha-cha?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear it. That's okay. So the main difference is that a lower BAC threshold once we're given a due cause. Studies show in Illinois and in Utah that lowering BAC limits has not led to overburdened courts or a major increase in arrests. It's a policy shift. It's a behavioral shift, not an enforcement expansion. Again, in Alaska, 1 in 3 traffic deaths involves a driver at 0.08 or higher. People are far more likely to be in fatal accidents when they are intoxicated. Some of the deaths that are happening here in our state are preventable. HB 308 addresses it. It's practical. It's evidence-based. It will save lives and will help shift norms in a state that urgently needs it. I respectfully urge your support. Thank you so much, Chair Gray, and all of your staff for this work. Thank all of you for your time. But I'm also remembering there were some other questions, so if it's okay, I can continue on with a couple of responses to some of those. I believe through the chair it was Rep. Mina who wondered why the U.S. is so far behind on these numbers, and there's no definition written down, but the way it looks is, number one, political compromise. In 2000, there was a political compromise that changed it to a nationwide 0.08 instead of being in charge at the state level. Many states still had 0.1. And involved in that political compromise is industry lobbying. They have over 300 lobbyists in Washington, D.C., and they got it to remain at 0.08. They are really pushing, and the United States has a very common perception that there's a perception in U.S. policy that the danger is only in chronic offenders, but actually that's not true. We see that 1 in 20, 5%, 1 in 20 of our deaths here are under that 0.08. Lobbyists are trying to say that the harms only happen in very severely intoxicated individuals, but only a small percentage of alcohol-impaired drivers are ever caught and processed through the judicial system. So a small minority of alcohol-related fatal crashes involve an identified chronic offender.
So it's really important to address this population level as well as for those chronic offenders. A couple of other things. Great question about the Utah 19.8% decrease. What did it look at? Was it just the law change? Was it the winter? I don't have all of that information right here, but I can also send you the studies. But I did want to point out that the rest of the nation saw a 5.6% fatal crash rate reduction in that same period. So Utah's was 14% greater. And I have one other thing about that. Sorry. Maybe I should just send it to you. While Utah experienced the 19.8% change. So overall, that decrease was 5.6% in 49 states other than Utah. Maybe I don't have anything besides what I just said. But this study said that the decrease in Utah was directly associated with the adoption and implementation of the 0.05 BAC law. There were three other states that also had larger decreases that same time period who had a number of known effective countermeasures, increase in traffic enforcement, increase in seatbelt use, decrease in speeding and other programs. So I'll just send you the full study. And then also about disparity, I don't have specific information on socioeconomic disparities, but we have thought about the concern with potential racial profiling by police. And there is no evidence that this has occurred in any country that lowered their BAC to 0.05, nor in Utah. I believe those are the questions that I tracked, but I'm here all day. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Hall. Are there any questions for Ms. Hall? Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And my apologies for interrupting you with your great presentation. I just asked, is there no cha-cha on the sobriety test? Because apparently it works. But I do have a serious question. In the information that you have about one out of three crashes involve, you know, this BAC, the lower BAC, is there any, do we make a distinction with these types of under the influence crashes that may involve like marijuana or other substances? Do we parse that out? And how could we track that? Is there any correlation to the BAC and someone's consumption of other substances that may impair their driving?
Through the chair, thanks for the question, Rep. Vance. It's a great question, and I don't know the answer, but I can try to look into it and get back to you. Also, per note, I think that when someone starts doing the cha-cha, that's actually additional proof of intoxication. Yes. And I also left one part out for Rep. Mina's other question about the U.S. Another really large factor is that we are a very car-centric nation. Mm-hmm. European countries and a lot of Asian countries have far more robust public transportation. And so there's belief that that's another reason why we have looser laws right now.
Thank you, Ms. Hall. At this time, we'll move on to our next invited testifier. That is Tom Chapman, a member of the National Transportation Safety Board. Mr. Chapman, will you please take yourself off mute, put yourself on the record, and begin your testimony?
Good afternoon, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Tom Chapman, and I have the honor of serving as the 46th member of the National Transportation Safety Board. I'm speaking to you from our offices in Washington, D.C. We very much appreciate the opportunity to testify in support of House Bill 308. Since 2013, the NTSB has recommended that states establish a per se BAC standard of 0.05 or lower. In 2018, as you've heard today, Utah became the first state to do so and subsequently saw reductions in both its fatal crash and fatality rates relative to the rest of the United States. passage of House Bill 308 in Alaska would make it the second state to embrace a change that will save lives and cut the number of senseless and completely avoidable crashes. In 2023, there were a staggering 12,429 alcohol-impaired driving fatalities in the United States. That represents 30% of all traffic fatalities in 2023. In Alaska, 25% of all traffic deaths were caused by alcohol-impaired driving crashes in 2023. Various countermeasures to combat alcohol-impaired driving have been tried over the years, and some have made a significant difference. Still, the number of crashes and deaths remains stubbornly high. More needs to be done, and research suggests that lowering the legal BAC standard will reduce fatal alcohol-related crashes by an estimated 11%. More than 100 countries have some type of 0.05 or lower standard, and the benefits of lower BAC standards are very well documented. Because we know it works, we at the NTSB strongly support legislation that will establish a legal BAC per se standard of 0.05 or lower. Addressing impaired driving on America's roads requires bold leadership. We applaud the bill sponsors and all of you as lawmakers for considering this key step. That concludes my statement on behalf of the National Transportation Safety Board, and I'd be very happy to take your questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chapman. Are there any questions from committee members? Representative Eichheit.
Thank you, Chair Gray. Through the chair, Mr. Chapman, you had said, if I heard correctly, in 2023 in Alaska, 25% of all deaths were alcohol-related. Did I read that correct?
Yes, that's the statistic we have. That number comes from the statistics kept by the National Highway Transportation Safety Administration.
And just as a follow-up, is that a typical percentage in other years? Because you just quoted 1 year, so I'm just curious if that's a typical percentage.
I don't have the statistic for Alaska beyond 2023. I would speculate, and it's informed speculation, that that's a pretty typical number. It has run at about 30% nationally for the last almost the last decade.
And just final follow up. I just noted it because our previous invited testimony said 1 in 3, I believe, and so that's 33%. So at some point, I'd just like to get clarity on statistics, please. Thank you.
Sure, we can look at that number. The 1 in 3, I would guess, encompasses a larger time frame than just the 1 year.
Any other questions?
I have one question, yeah.
Representative Kopp.
Yeah, Mr. Chapman, thank you, sir, for your testimony. How long has the NTSB been advocating for states to lower the BAC to 0.05 or lower?
That recommendation was made by NTSB in 2013, and we reiterated it several times.
Okay, so in the last 13 years, can you explain why states are not doing that? What has been your experience?
Well, some of that, I think, is political inertia. These are not easy decisions to make, and some of the discussion I've heard today, which, by the way, has been a very productive discussion, there are some significant questions that always come up in the context of these proposals. We actually are working in support of proposals in several other states, also looking at 0.05. It's not an easy change to make. The change to 0.08 in the early 2000s was a result of congressional action, which established changing the standard to 0.08 as a condition of receiving federal highway funds. We don't have that sort of incentive with regard to the change to 0.05. And so this is sort of a state-by-state effort at this point.
Thank you.
At ease. Back on the record. Representative Mina.
Thank you, Chair Gray. Through the chair, Looking into the bill packet and the supporting documents, you know, I learned a little bit more about the history of the states lowering their BAC to 0.08. And it looks like prior to the 2000s law change that there was a significant public health awareness and publicity campaign about the impacts of having a 0.08 BAC in the 80s. And so along the lines of Representative Kopp's questioning, what public health campaigns has there been to help mobilize more public support for lowering the BAC?
Mr. Chapman.
Well, that's an excellent question. It actually relates to the experience in Utah. There were questions about the initial decline in fatality rates in Utah and what are the factors might have influenced that. One important factor is that a component of the law in Utah was a mandated public awareness campaign of the fact that the standard was being lowered to 0.05. We believe that that was very important in building public awareness and frankly, in maintaining a public understanding of the fact that the standard is lower, and it has helped generate essentially a cultural shift in the way folks in Utah approach drinking and driving. So I think that it would certainly be helpful if there were a broad national public awareness campaign of some sort. I don't know that that's in the offing at the moment. We do a lot of work on this issue at NTSB. Some of the other federal agencies, NHTSA does as well. But in terms of what might be done on a state-by-state basis, I would certainly commend the Utah experience to you. We think that the effort in Utah to build awareness of the 0.05 standard was very helpful in generating some of the benefits that we saw in the wake of the 0.05 standard being adopted.
Thank you for the information.
Any other questions for Mr. Chapman before we open public testimony? Mr. Chapman, thank you so much for being here today and for your testimony. We will now move on to public testimony. Public testimony is now open. We are going to begin by going online. I am going to call on Mike Coons in Wasilla. Please take yourself off mute, place yourself on the record, and begin your testimony.
Yes, my name is Mike Coons from Wasilla, and I'm speaking for myself as a retired paramedic firefighter. I sadly oppose HB 308. As to the intent of this bill, good intentions are paved with bad outcomes. We as a nation went after drunk drivers and put into law a 0.08 blood alcohol standard, yet we have people driving drunk from that level and much higher. This legislation does nothing as to putting teeth into consequences. As a paramedic, I can't count the number of times I've had to treat people who have been harmed or killed by repeat drunk drivers. I've had to treat these drunk drivers, mainly because they didn't want to get arrested, who had no remorse and could care less. I have had to console victims while watching the drunk driver being walked to a police cruiser with a smug smile. Yes, it is the responsibility of the driver not to be under the influence. Those actions, though, are made okay by judges that do not give harsh punishments because the statutes are lenient to begin with. I've heard far too many times of after a judge's sentence that the person then goes out to his car and drives away. We have judges that give a slap on the hand for DUIs. We have people that even after multiple convictions, driver's license suspended or taken, still drive and drunk drive. Just watch cops. Yet DUIs for up to two times are misdemeanors with a maximum 1 year for a second offense. A third offense then becomes a felony with mandatory minimum 60 under a misdemeanor to 120 days, which is considered a felony, maximum of 5 years. To the sponsor, if you want to make a difference, then put forward changes to the statutes with mandatory minimums and those minimums far higher than they are today. Make first offense 3 days in jail, no ankle bracelets, no community residential center. Second offense, mandatory minimum 1 year, no time off for good behavior, but suspension of 5 years. Third mandatory minimum, 10 years, no time off for good behavior, revoke the DL. Driving under suspension, 2 to 5 years in prison, lifetime revoking of DL. Any of the above, and if the driving under influence results in hitting another, or causing injury, first offense, mandatory 5 years with set injuries 10 to 25, second and above, 25 years, life and death results. All this bill does is clog up the courts so judges can continue to slap pinkies and show that this behavior is okay by no real consequences to take off the road people who don't give a damn about other people's safety. By and large, there is no justice for the victims of DUI. We coddle these people in large part because we don't want to fill out their our jails and prisons with victimless crimes. Hold a person bleeding out with a DUI crash and tell me that it's a victimless crime. Let's enforce the law instead of this. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. We'll now move to Bernie Hoffman in Fairbanks. Please take yourself off mute, place yourself on the record, and begin your testimony.
Can you hear me?
We can.
Representative? Oh, great. Thank you. Well, hey, I want to thank you for bringing forth this legislation and you and the committee for taking this time for this testimony. I want to talk to you all one-on-one because I was a victim of a drunk driver. And I have been asking some of my representatives here in Fairbanks, you know, we need to do more to change this. I read the blotter sheet and drunk driving hasn't gone down here. I mean, there's still people that are that appear in the drunk driver. In fact, the guy who hit us killed my partner at the time. He continued to go on and drive and get DUIs with a suspended license. And you know, I mean, something needs to be done. And what the fellow who testified before me, he has some really good points. There needs to be some changes, definitely. And, you know, and it has affected me for all these years. It affected my earning abilities because it damaged my body big time. Even as a young person getting hit 40 years ago, I still have the pain and all the injuries. And, but I support you and I hope you continue to work on this and make it better for, Alaskans, because I tell you, it does affect everybody. It affects the whole system. And he's right. I mean, innocent people get killed, and we were out garage selling, and we got hit by a person with epileptic drinking and driving, going 85 miles an hour on the road. There's something needs to be changed in our system. And Representative Gray, you're right. European countries, they slap major penalties against people for drinking and driving. And yes, we do have transportation problems in this country, which definitely agree with. But I know it's a work in progress, but I thank you for addressing this. And, you know, because it affects all Alaskans. You know, anyone can get hit by a drunk driver. It can affect you in a split second. Your life will change, believe me. And the life of the loved ones and the people around you will change. So anyway, thank you for your time and attention, and have a very good day, and take care of yourself down there. Please.
Thank you so much for your testimony, Ms. Hoffman. Seeing no further testimony online, we'll move into the room. Stella Aquino, if you will come forward, place yourself on the record, and begin your testimony.
Hello. Let the records show. My name is Stella Aquino, and I am representing myself. I would like to thank the committee and the chairs for giving me this opportunity. Okay. Hello. My name is Stella Aquino, and I am an eighth grader at Stellar Secondary. Right now, Alaskan laws for driving under the influence are out of date with current research. We have the opportunity to update them. This is an important issue to me because I was involved in an accident involving someone under the influence. Currently, to be arrested in Alaska, your blood alcohol must be 0.08 or higher. Research shows that the impacts of alcohol, such as slurred speech and reduced muscle coordination, can occur when blood alcohol is as low as 0.4. The United States defined 0.08 as the legal limit based on visual impairment. However, alcohol impacts the whole body. Having a 0.04 blood alcohol can level can be just as dangerous as a 0.08, depending on the person and the situation, and can have a similar effect on the ability to drive. To change this law, people need to better understand the impacts of drunk driving. The first step is gathering data and research. Currently, drunk driving causes 10,000 to 13,000 deaths annually in the United States, and there are nearly 37 deaths per day. All these deaths were preventable. One example of success is in Utah. The DUI law in Utah defines 0.05 as the legal blood alcohol level, which is lower than Alaska and the rest of the U.S. Utah only has 40 to 70 drunk driving deaths per year, which is much lower than the national average. Once data and information like this are collected, we can educate our community with these facts so they understand how preventable drunk driving crashes are. Okay. In the year 2000, President Clinton signed a regulation in the United States to lower the permissible blood alcohol content to 0.08, the first federal requirement. He stated that lowering the limit will make responsible Americans take greater care when they drink alcohol in any amount and if they intend to drive. And it should. The science at the time supported the 0.08 as the right level. Since that time, there has been more research on the impact of alcohol on people. This has led to other laws, like the Alaska law for commercial driver's license, to define 0.04 as the limit. The rule of law states that all citizens must abide by the same laws, regardless of political power. The laws must be stable and justly applied. Right now, the rule of law is not being fairly applied, because the CDLs and regular driver's license have different standards. All vehicles driven by someone under the influence are dangerous to others on the road, and the law should be justly applied. The solution shows both moderation and respect for Alaskans. Reducing the blood alcohol level to 0.04 is not an extreme solution, and is realistic and achievable. This solution also shows respect for people, as it will increase the safety for every person using the roads. Our youth wants to change. They want to grow. They want to make decisions for their own. They want to not listen to their parents. They want to learn from their mistakes. If we pass this bill, our youth will have a better future and much less drunk driving accidents and deaths. It will take all of us as a community to make a change. Together, we can save lives.
Thank you, Ms. Aquino. Is there anyone else in the room that would like to testify? Seeing no further testifiers in the room or online, public testimony on House Bill 308 is now closed. Are there any final questions or comments before we move on? Representative Costello.
Thank you. And I know I speak for all the members in just letting the last testifier know how wonderful it was to have a young person come to Juneau and testify in person on a bill. And you did a really fabulous job. Thank you.
Yes, you are our first eighth grader to testify this year. Thank you. Representative Mina.
Thank you, Chair Gray. Through the chair, or just a comment. I guess first I do also echo Representative Costello's comment. Great job on the testimony. I was looking into that 2022 NHTSA study on Utah, and it looks like they studied the 21 months after the Utah law's passage, and then they also looked at data on 12 months after the implementation. My understanding is that the Utah law passed in 2017. So I would be curious about if there's any new data from Utah or if there's other studies from other countries where they've lowered their BAC from 0.08 to 0.05. Thank you.
Before we move on, I'm just going to say like the history of this bill. I had this bill drafted when I first got elected and put it in a drawer because my staff at the time said, this is extremely controversial. You do not want to file this bill. And so I put it in a drawer. And this year our staff decided that we didn't care if something was controversial. But I just want to make the point that I did not know all of this information. I thought that we were doing something really drastic and bold, as Representative Vance said. But thanks to my intern's great work and getting all this information, we're actually just getting in line with the rest of the world. It actually, I mean, this actually makes sense. And it wasn't as crazy an idea as we thought when we had this bill drafted a few years ago. So I just wanted to like put that out there that I was not as sold on this when I started working on this bill until this moment. I have been moved by the data. So we will set an amendment deadline for House Bill 308 for Wednesday, April 1st, 2026 at 11:59 p.m. Please work with my committee aide to ensure that amendments are submitted on time. We will now set House Bill 308 aside and bring it up at a later date. We are now on to House Bill 324, Virtual Currency Kiosks. Our next item of business is, at this time, I would like to invite the sponsor, Representative Moore, and her staff, Inti Mayo Harbison, to the witness table. And either of you are free to make any opening comments that you would like.
Thank you, Co-Chair Gray and Co-Chair Kopp for having us here and the members of the committee. Just to refresh, House Bill 324, I'm sorry, for the record, Lexi Moore, District 28. So just to refresh the committee, House Bill 324, Act Relating to Virtual Currency in Kiosks. And so it addresses the growing gap in our state's financial regulatory framework, the unregulated rise of virtual currency kiosks, commonly known as Bitcoin ATMs. While Alaska embraces tech innovation right now, we must ensure that these new financial tools are not weaponized by bad actors and that want to defraud Alaskans. That is happening so commonly right now with these kiosks. And so if there are any more questions or anything that we can answer for the committee.
Thank you, Representative Moore. Any questions for the sponsor before we take up amendments? The amendment deadline for House Bill 324 was Wednesday, March 18th at 11:59 p.m. Our office received two amendments. Do we have a motion for Amendment 1?
I move Amendment 1.
Object for purposes of discussion. Representative Costello.
Mr. Chair, if I could have my aide, Zach Young, present the amendment.
Yes. Mr. Young, if you would like to come forward, place yourself on the record and explain Amendment 1.
Good afternoon, Chair Gray and members of the House Judiciary Committee. My name is Zach, for the record, my name is Zach Young, staff to Representative Costello. Amendment 1 requires that a hold for all new customers of 48 hours would be implemented by all kiosks existing in Alaska. In addition to this, it would add disclosure requirements for the amount of the hold and the time at which it will be released. This will provide new customers with additional protections so that they may receive a refund without having the money expended and actually going to the scammer or the fraudster that would be receiving those funds.
Thank you, Mr. Young. Any questions for the amendment sponsor staff? I'd like to call Representative Moore forward. If you would give us your opinion on Amendment 1. I'll also state for the record that online we have Dan Fleer and Tracy Reno from the Division of Banking and Securities if there are any questions for them.
For the record, Alexi Moore, District 28. Amendment number 1 is a really great stepping stone in the process of these guardrails, for sure. I think that when we are looking at the fraud and the activities happening on these kiosks, it's coming from already existing users that have these accounts. The perpetrator is asking victims to go to the kiosk and deposit money into an account already established. So while for new Bitcoin patrons that want to come and open up a business, I think the 48-hour rule is wonderful. I think it needs to be extended to all transactions to be the most effective. But this is a friendly amendment and one that I think is important to
to build on and to move forward with. And I don't know if there's something else that my staff would like to say. Okay, great.
Thank you, Representative Moore. Representative Costello, are you open to putting a 48-hour hold on all transactions?
Mr. Chair, so my office just looked into the new transactions. So at this time, I think it would be better to do some more research on that before we make that change. But I think it would be the sponsor who you would want to be working with.
Thank you. Any questions or comments on Amendment 1? Representative Underwood.
Thank you. Through the chair, I just want a clarification. So this is a friendly amendment that you guys would support for this bill?
For the record, Alexi Moore, through the chair, Representative Underwood, yes, this is a friendly amendment.
Thanks.
I remove my objection. Seeing no further objections, Amendment 1 has been adopted. We will now take up Amendment 2.
I move Amendment 2.
Object.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. My intention here for Amendment 2 is to withdraw it before we get to that point. But I just did want to have that conversation so that moving forward, this conversation is on the record with what we're intending to do with Amendment 2. And if I could have my aide, Zach Young, explain it.
Thank you. Mr. Young.
For the record, Zach Young, staff to Representative Costello. Amendment 2 would remove the current refunds section of the bill. The current refunds section states, amongst many things, that if the transaction has been placed by the originator or a new or existing customer, and there was fraud involved, then there is an opportunity for the defrauded individual to, through a process, including a police report and reporting to the kiosk owner, receive all of the funds that were incurred or lost by that individual. This amendment would actually align the current statute that governs money transaction or money transfer licensees as of now with this bill, creating parity between what current virtual transaction or virtual kiosk transaction licensees have to go through. The reason for this is because it would shift the liability from the person that is being defrauded, it's a very unfortunate situation, to the owner of the business or the owner of the kiosk, and they would have to take on the responsibility of that fraud. It also creates opportunity for fraudsters to harvest multiple different people and then have them refunded their money so they get both sides. Because hypothetically, if a fraudster were to groom a person to go and make that transaction and then receive both the money that they defrauded for the individual and the money that was refunded, there's not a reasonable enough standard that a police officer would be able to ascertain that that's occurring through what is currently the legal process.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Is there anyone online who could just comment on this amendment?
Sure. Mr. Fleer or Ms. Reno, can either of you comment on Amendment 2 by Representative Costello?
Through the chair, Tracy Reno, Director of the Division of Banking and Securities. The division is neutral on this amendment. We don't have any concerns with it at this time.
I have a question for you.
I have another comment on the other amendment if I have a moment.
Okay.
Later.
Do you want her?
You do have a comment. On
okay. Representative Costello has a question for you, Director Reno.
Director Reno, could you walk us through what does happen currently with money transfer licensees? Just to back up what my office has learned and what was testified to in the introduction of the amendment.
Through the chair, Tracy Reno, Director of Division of Banking and Securities. What happens regarding money transition licensees in regards to what specifically?
through the chair, in regards to fraud?
Through the chair, Tracy Reno, Division of Banking and Securities Director. Regarding fraud related to cryptocurrency kiosks or in general fraud?
So the amendment puts cryptocurrency kiosks in line with other money transfer licensees. And so my question has to do with the money transfer licensees and the process involving fraud with those entities that are already under your purview.
Understood. Tracy Reno, Division of ATN Securities. My understanding is that currently when a person files a complaint with the Division of Banking and Securities related to a fraudulent transaction, our staff will contact the licensee. We will request information regarding the transaction. We will conduct an investigation. If it's related to cryptocurrency, we have software that will help us track where that money went, where the wallet went, where the crypto went through each wallet. And then we can see where it ended up. Sometimes we are able to reach out to that jurisdiction if it's within the states or with the company that we currently license, and we may be able to request that those funds are clawed back. But that is not often the case with cryptocurrency. Usually it's gone. If it's a regular money transmission with, you know, U.S. currency or, you know, some other foreign currency, we are able to reach out to that company, ask them to investigate that transaction, and they will, you know, if it's a fraudulent transaction, shut that account down. They can look into reporting that transaction as a suspicious activity to the federal government so that law enforcement can take a look at that and see if it's, you know, part of a bigger crime ring and see if there's something they can do to prevent that in the future. But basically, we get a complaint, we investigate, we take action to determine if the company has done their due diligence to investigate and report and see if they can, you know, do anything to get those funds back. Does that answer your question?
Thank you. So it's my understanding that your regulations currently allow you to consider cryptocurrency as a money transfer licensee. However, this bill actually would put that in statute that they have to then register. My question is, the way can you still help in that capacity, the way this bill is written? Can you work with the defrauded Alaskan and go through the steps that you just described to the committee?
Through the chair, Tracy Reno, Division of Banking and Securities. We currently have jurisdiction over cryptocurrency as of January 1st of 23. We have it in regulation that cryptocurrency is considered a thing of value that is transmitted. So we currently have jurisdiction over cryptocurrency. We currently have six companies that have 76 virtual currency kiosks throughout the state, and they are regulated by the division under the Uniform Money Services Act, AS-0655, they are required to report those kiosks as registered agent locations. So we do have authority over them. We do get complaints on them, and we do investigate them.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Moore, can you comment on Amendment 2?
You know, I will let my staff comment on Amendment number 2. He's a little bit more versed on this one.
Thank you, Chair Gray. For the record, into Mile Harbison, stop to Representative Moore. What we see across the United States with similar amendments, and I understand what Representative Costello is trying to do here in making sure that the state regulators who currently regulate cryptocurrency have the tools that they need in order to do this. What I would caution the committee on is in a number of other states where cryptocurrency bills have gone through the legislative process, they have been amended in a number of ways that have actually created larger loopholes for cryptocurrency fraud to occur. The legislation that was brought to us has gone through a number of legislatures in other states. It is very narrow on what it does and is trying to do. And so I would caution the committee that taking any action to sway from a tighter regulation of these industries may inadvertently cause a loophole that we aren't trying to create.
Thank you, Mr. Harbison. Representative Costello.
Well, it was my intention to have the discussion and then withdraw the amendment, so I withdraw the amendment.
Thank you. Amendment 2 has been withdrawn. Director Reno, would you like to make your comment on Amendment 1, which we've already adopted?
Through the chair, Tracy Reno, Division of Banking and Securities. We had a minor concern about the amendment related to the 48-hour hold for the initial transaction. Related to virtual currency kiosk transactions. If a transaction was a first, the initial transaction for an account, and it happened on a Friday night and there's a 48-hour hold, that may not be long enough for a victim to be able to report a fraudulent transaction if we have a weekend or a holiday, and suggesting that you may consider something a little bit longer or perhaps exclude holidays or be specific about business days.
Thank you for your comment. At ease. Does this go in? Record. Seeing as this bill has another committee of referral after this committee, it could be extended to 72 hours in the next committee of referral. Seeing no further questions. And having listened to none of the above, are there any other questions for staff? For staff or the sponsor with House Bill 324? Do we have a motion?
Mr. Chair, at this time I move that House Bill 324, Work Order 34-LS1515/A as amended, be reported out of the House Judiciary Committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Hearing no objection, House Bill 324, Work Order 34-LS1515/A as in alpha, as amended, is reported out of the House Judiciary Committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note. I authorize Legislative Legal Services to make any necessary technical and conforming changes. We will take a brief at ease to sign the paperwork. Back on the record, our final item of business is House Bill 136, Railroad Utility Corridors. At this time, I would like to invite the sponsor, Vice Chair Kopp, and his staff, Grace Irvine, to the witness table. Vice Chair Kopp, would you like to make any additional comments about your bill at this time?
Chair Gray, thank you. I appreciate the work of the committee and the previous committee on this bill. Just a brief review, Mr. Chair, this bill, in practical terms, just requires a fair and balanced consideration of non-interfering uses of the underlying landowners in locations where the railroad easement crosses lands the Alaska Railroad does not own. It preserves the railroad's authority over track crossings where safety and engineering standards apply. And for property owners, it restores ordinary property rights and prevents unexpected railroad fees or permits for non-interfering activities in the easement area. For the railroad, it helps them maintain operational safety authority and keeps them in complete control over crossings and anything that affects rail operations. And for other public uses of the right-of-way, House Bill 136 in no way changes the current statutory provisions and process for future public uses of the railroad right-of-way. The Alaska Corporation is an extension of the state, is meant to act as a good neighbor. This legislation just sets a policy saying, yes, we want you to behave accordingly and working with property owners to resolve issues in the least arduous way possible. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Vice Chair Kopp. As a reminder, the amendment deadline on House Bill 136 was Thursday, February 26th at 5 p.m. Our office received no amendments. Does anyone have any final questions or comments for the sponsor about House Bill 136? Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to say to Representative Kopp, let's get this done. Like, I will be the first to sign your chit. You have been championing this for so long. And I remember former Representative Tom McKay was also trying to help encourage the railroad to be good neighbors there in Anchorage as well. And I think this bill is a good resolution that allows them, you know, to continue to exercise the authority they need to when needed, but also respects the property owners. And that is something that I think Alaskans are going to, you know, be very proud that you've stayed the course on this. So thank you for that.
Thank you, Representative Vance. Thank you. Representative Mina.
Thank you, Chair Gray. Through the chair, I just want to thank you, Representative Kopp, for being open to a lot of the different comments about the bill throughout its process. I just had one question related to testimony that was submitted by Mr. Ed Martin, and I think he had testified on this bill in support of it during its last hearing, and he just brought up some other questions about potential invitation on federal litigation. And I was just wondering if you had read that letter and if you could just comment or respond to some of those different remarks.
Yes. So through the chair, Representative Mina, there would be nothing federally to litigate by the state setting a management policy for the right-of-way because we are not challenging any federal court decision. We're just setting a management policy saying this is how we're going to manage our right-of-way. And our Department of Law was online, has confirmed that, yes, it's our right-of-way and we can manage it however we want as a matter of policy. But I do not see this inviting any litigation at all federally because we're not trying to undo any federal court decision here.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Any other final comments or questions? Seeing no further questions or comments, do we have a motion?
Mr. Chair, at this time, I move that House Bill 136, Work Order 34-LS0640/T, be reported out of the House Judiciary Committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Hearing no objection, House Bill 136, Work Order 34-LS0640/T is in tango, is reported out of the House Judiciary Committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note. I authorize Legislative Legal Services to make any necessary technical and conforming changes. We will hold off on signing the paperwork until we gavel out because we are almost done for the day. That concludes today's business before the committee. Before we adjourn, I would like to remind everyone of upcoming amendment deadlines, as we have several. The amendment deadline for the following bills is tonight, March 25th at 11:59 p.m. HB 298, Legislative Ethics Committee and Proceedings. HB 74, Crime, Counterfeit, Non-Functioning Airbag. HJR 43, Voter Privacy. HJR 31, Constitutional Amendments, Corporations, and Rights, and HJR 41, Rescind Requests for Constitutional Convention. The time is now 2:54 p.m., and this hearing of the House Judiciary Committee is adjourned. Please do not leave. We need to sign paperwork. Adjourned.